Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. Joining me on backup vocals today, there's Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, glad to be singing with you.
Excellent.
In this folk era.
Also joining me on stage on tambourine, Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello, everyone. I'm back. It's been a while.
Back. Is it safe to say that you were both back and better than ever, or are you just kind of keeping it?
I fell out of the furnace and I wound up inside Llewyn Davis.
Well, interesting. Can't wait to hear that. Did you take
glad I'm back here now?
Did you take a side trip through Nebraska?
There was some desolation of Smaug.
All right. Well, today we are, if you couldn't pick up from Nick's strange statement, we're talking about Inside Llewyn Davis. That's going to be our main review. Before we get into that, we will be having a brief review of Nebraska, the newest film by Alexander Payne that is starring Bruce Stern and Will Forte. Before we get into that, I guess apologies for not being here last week, but you know, we are people with lives and sometimes scheduling is a nightmare. But we have overcome those difficulties and we are back on the streets, back in your earbuds. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do that at podcast@thefilmstage.com or post a comment on this post on thefilmstage.com. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, it's Christmas time. So if you'd like to get us a present to thank us for all the hard work we put into this, it'd be great if you could go to iTunes and give us a comment and a rating. 5 stars are appreciated, but we ask that you also be honest with yourself and with us. So give us the rating you see fit, let us know how we can improve or what you like, and we'd greatly appreciate it. So that's that. Let's get into the show at large. We'll start off today by giving a brief spoiler-free review of Alexander Payne's Nebraska. Danny and I saw this. Nick, you have not, correct?
No, this is an opportunity for me to go get a bowl of cereal.
Oh, fantastic. What kind of cereal will you be getting?
Probably Honey Nut Cheerios.
Okay. All right.
Nebraska Flakes?
No, I don't have any. That sounds really dry. And
the most depressing cereal ever. Oh, man. Yeah, you know, I was going to get some honey almond flax, but I realized I had no milk. So anyway, Nebraska, the newest film by Alexander Payne, written by Bob Nelson. This is a film about a young man who decides to take his father from Montana to Nebraska after his father, in his senility and naivete, believes that he has won $1 million from a publishing sweepstakes. Danny King, what were your thoughts on Nebraska?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked. So I first saw Nebraska like a couple months ago, sort of around the time of like the New York Film Festival, and I was really high on it. And I watched it again last night with my parents, which was a really interesting experience. Because I just got home for winter break, and I'm from Chicago. And like Bruce Stern is a Chicago guy, and this is like a very Midwestern story. So I figure they might kind of be into it, but they both really didn't like the movie. And the fact that they didn't like it sort of confirmed a few things for me about like why this movie might be tough to access for some people. And like one thing is that I think it has one of the more like insane MacGuffins I've seen in like a recent movie. Like the fact that this whole plot is revolved around something that's a clear scam. Because if you're like watching this movie and like 45 minutes into it or something, you're asking like he didn't really win any money. If that's what you're thinking about, you're not really like thinking about the film in the way it wants you to. You're supposed to really be like focusing on all these details that are sort of sparsed out throughout the film, and you're supposed to kind of not even worry about the plot, to be honest. So that's one thing that I think is kind of tough to get past. And another thing is that Bruce Dern is like a really weird actor. There's kind of a reason he's never been a leading man before. If you like go back and look at some of his more famous films, like The Driver or Coming Home, he's like a really strange screen presence, and he has like this kind of Weasley voice. And there's a reason he's always been in supporting roles. And so in this movie, I think it's like he can be a tough presence to connect with because he's so patient at times, and the character, his words are like very carefully chosen. He can come off as a passive character perhaps. It was interesting to like, while I was watching this film with my parents, to maybe think about it, if it would have starred Gene Hackman, who was Payne's original choice, because I think if you put Gene Hackman in this role, people would sit through this movie easy, and they would be way more inclined to go with it. But something about Dern, it's like he's such a tough kind of presence to engage with. And honestly, like if you put Bruce Dern in this movie, like Will Forte becomes the lead for a lot of people just based on the fact that he's like more famous and like more recognizable. So those are a few things that I think is like could be tough about the movie for some people. But what I appreciated about it was just this sort of very careful building of information and the way you sort of learn about this character through these sort of side offhand scenes. And there are a few standouts we could talk about without spoiling. But by the end of the film, you really get a full picture of like a life that never was. And it's a kind of very bittersweet ending because there's a nice little moment at the end that some could kind of read as sentimental, but it's really, it's more bittersweet for me because of all this sort of regret that builds up throughout the film. And I thought it was quite powerful by the time it ended.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I loved this movie. And it was interesting to see Bruce Dern in the role. And I think he actually, like you say, Gene Hackman was an original choice. And I can't imagine him doing with this character what Bruce Dern was able to do.
Yeah.
I have a review of this on my personal website, Dear Film, and I say at some point that like his character does not evolve throughout the movie. You know, he's an old man. He's at the end of his life. Like, there's not really much evolving he can do. And not much that he needs to do, really, but that his performance is so layered that as we gain more information about him, we are able to see in him all the things that we had missed before just because we never had that information. And his rapport with Will Forte, it's like, it's very easy for the father and son relationship to not play in a movie. Just like the brother relationship is easy to not play in a movie. But if you have the right people, even if they might not look like each other or act like each other, you can still see the relationship between them. And everyone in this movie is really good at that, especially Bob Odenkirk, who plays...
He's really good.
Yeah, and he plays Will Forte's brother. Yeah, I don't know. There was something strangely elegiac and slightly uplifting about this movie that I really enjoyed. I liked the interpersonal relationships that they'd built. I liked the use of the black and white photography, which I know for a lot of people just reeks of art house pretension, but in this film it really does add to the emotional resonance of the film. It removes a layer of artifice and opacity that like the coloring would have given it, that would have made it harder to really dig into the emotional depths that these people were applying. So I loved Nebraska. It was a fantastic movie. And like you said, Danny, I mean, there are some scenes in this film that are just like knockout. There's a scene that takes place in a cemetery. Really, really almost any scene with June Squibb, who plays Will Forte's mother, Bruce Dern's wife. I mean, she is fantastic in this movie. And she's another one of those characters where, like, you think that she's this flat, one-dimensional, like, the old woman with no filter who's kind of mean. But the more that you see that play out and the more you find out about her, the more you grow in your affection for her, and suddenly the mystery of the relationship between these two people doesn't seem so impenetrable anymore.
At the same time, though, like, you also get this information about, like, all these past relationships that Woody had, who's the Dern character. So, like, that scene in the newspaper office that he's not even in, it's between Will Forte and, like, the editor of the town newspaper who used to, like, go out with Woody. And it's like, you watch that scene, and then the next time you kind of alluded to this, like, the next time you see Bruce Dern right after that scene, it's like a whole new layer has been added to his face and his physicality. And you sort of wonder, like, how his life could have very easily been different in all these different ways. And there's a scene late that I won't spoil with Stacy Keach, where you get another kind of piece of information like that. And it sort of seems very true to life. Not that that's necessarily like a way to praise a movie, like, oh yeah, stuff like that happens, but like just this idea that really important life decisions are sometimes not made like with incredible care and thoughtfulness. You kind of just go with it. Yeah. And there's sort of like something resonant about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What'd you guys think of the score?
Oh, it's a great score.
I was going to say, in recollection, I have no memory of the score.
Yeah, it's really good.
Okay.
Yeah, I've heard kind of divergent things on it. So
it was
in the trailer. I saw the trailer yesterday, and I liked the music in the trailer. So
yeah,
I was just curious.
I mean, because there's a lot of landscape shots, so the score is pretty prominent.
Yeah, there's a lot of interstitial moments where they just kind of take in the atmosphere and the environment. I mean, here's how I'll qualify my statement on the score. If I didn't like it, because I liked everything else so much, it probably would have really stuck out to me. I'm going to assume that it was fine.
Okay.
I was actually, this is interesting, because I'll bring this up because we're talking about Llewyn Davis. Last year, I bought like 4 different film soundtracks and scores. And this year, I haven't really felt the need to do that for any of them. So I'm wondering what that says. At the same time, however, last year I had like 7 top 10 films that I really felt strongly about, and the rest were kind of just filler. And this year I've currently got like 25 films vying for top 10. So maybe there's an inverse relationship between the overall quality of films and my noticing the score. Time will tell. Yeah, so Danny and I are both highly enthusiastic about Nebraska. Any final thoughts that we should apply out on this film, or should we just tell people to go see it?
Yeah, check it out. I can't imagine it's making any money. I actually haven't bothered to look at the box office.
I'm sad to say that I agree with you about that. Which is funny, because his last film, Descendants, didn't that make a tidy sum?
Descendants was a really big success.
Yeah, that was a popular film.
Yeah, certainly like Clooney would help that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It also had a wider release, but again, that's probably the Clune.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's Nebraska. Check it out. It's in limited release now. Yeah, that's it. So let's talk about our feature review, which is the newest film by...
You want to talk about the review? That's very meta.
Right? Let's talk about the movie. Then we'll talk about the review of the movie.
Wow, this is... I don't know if I can do that.
You can't do that? All right, so let's just talk about the movie then. Let's make it easy. It's Nick's first week back. We don't want to overwhelm him.
Yeah,
so let's
ease back in.
Slowly but surely. So let's talk about the newest film by the Coen brothers. That's Inside Llewyn Davis. And this is starring Oscar Isaac, Carey Mulligan, Justin Timberlake, and many, many other fine people drop by as well to lend their talents, even if ever so briefly. People like Adam Driver, John Goodman, Garrett Hedlund.
No, Goodman? You said that?
I said Goodman, yes.
Mulligan?
Oh my god. All right. Anyway, here's the trailer.
Explain the cat.
What's its name?
I don't know. He snuck out the door.
Do you think he was staying here tonight?
Leaving. Oh. I was hoping to. So, I can't stay here tonight.
If I had wings, I'd know where to.
What'd you say you played?
Folk songs.
Folk songs. Solo act?
No, I had a partner. Threw himself off the George Washington Bridge.
George Washington Bridge? You throw yourself off the Brooklyn Bridge, traditionally. George Washington Bridge. Who does that?
I think we should have like 20 minutes in silence after the trailer so that people can get Fairly Well out of their heads before they start listening to us.
Is this the Bob Dylan song or the one recorded for the movie?
The one recorded for the movie. The one that plays at the beginning on the record.
Right.
For the film.
Anyway. So, Inside Llewyn Davis is the story of a young man trying to make a name for himself as a folk singer in Greenwich Village in, I believe, 1961. And it tracks about a week in his life as he shuffles from gig to gig and manages his personal and professional problems. Nick Newman, since you didn't get a chance to talk at all during the last review, why don't we start off with you? What are your thoughts on Inside Llewyn Davis?
My thoughts on this film, I think, go deeper than I think it goes deeper than just kind of a reaction to the film as is. If you're friends with me on Facebook or if you follow me on Twitter, you probably saw my reaction last night, which was one of post-traumatic stress a bit. Okay. Where, let me just say up front that I like this film a lot. I thought it was, you know, I mean, I guess there was sort of an auteur thing with the Coen brothers where if you have seen their recent films and you kind of know them, you can sort of, the fact that I like them very much can kind of almost tell you why I like this movie, I think. Sort of the basic components of their films, both formally and thematically, kind of apply here. And so we'll get to that a bit more. But right now, let me just say that when I was watching this movie, I always felt very uncomfortable and I couldn't quite pin down why. And then pretty much as soon as the movie ended, pretty much as soon as I walked out of the very small theater I saw it in, because I made the 6-second walk from, you know, the theater to outside, it just kind of hit me how much I related to this main character and also how much the movie's tone, sort of its atmosphere, kind of reflects like just my mood all the time. And so to that end, watching this movie was very uncomfortable. And it just kind of, I can't remember the last 2013 movie. I don't know if there is a 2013 movie that I saw, and afterward I just kind of, when I got home, I just kind of sat there for a bit and just kind of thought about a lot of things. This movie fucked me up, I gotta say, in a way I really didn't expect. But otherwise it was good. I liked it. I thought Oscar Isaac was really terrific. And I think that he's kind of has a perfect, even it's weird, he's actually Hispanic, but he has very much a, and I'm not sure if the character is Jewish, but he definitely has a Jewiness to him that feels very Coen-esque. And he kind of carries that perfectly. And I think he blends in well with the design of the world, which definitely feels like it is the 60s in New York City. That was sort of immaculate, which I was almost a bit surprised by, because I know this movie wasn't made on a huge budget, but they really used every penny of it, clearly. It was a very enriching experience. It's, not my favorite film of theirs and not even my favorite recent film of theirs, but overall it was very satisfying.
All right. Excellent. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I quite loved this film that I saw a couple weeks ago. I would probably put it near the top of their canon for me. With the qualification though that I think their last few films have all been, except for True Grit, honestly, which I didn't like much when I first saw it, but like No Country for Old Men, A Serious Man, and this. I think those are like three perfect movies.
Burn After Reading's really good.
Burn After Reading's really good. Yeah, I agree. And it's really underrated. But yeah, they're just like working at this incredibly high level right now. And it's interesting to see the response to this movie, because a lot of the people who like the film are sort of saying things like, you know, I usually, and this could apply to Pain too, honestly, but a lot of people are kind of saying like, I sometimes feel like they condescend to their characters.
Yeah, that is one of the biggest things about them.
Yeah. And
that impression of them.
And people are kind of saying that this one is different, that it's warmer or whatever. But you know, that might be true. Like, if you look at the opening scene, it's hard not to like just love that character after that opening song and just follow him anywhere, because it's just so delicate and kind of very evocative. And but the worldview of the film is like brutal. And I guess that's Nick's worldview.
I was about to say, Nick saying that he identifies with this character so heavily kind of both explains a lot and raises a lot of questions.
Yeah, because it's basically very much like A Serious Man in terms of you have this character just sort of caught in this like cycle of hell. And it's very troubling. But one of the things I responded to other than that was just this idea of setting the film in this time period. And the opening scene actually works as a good starting point for this, because you start the film and you see like Gaslight Cafe and you get this really romantic performance and you're like, oh, wow, it's the 60s. Like, this is so pretty. And then it just sort of deconstructs it from there. And I kind of appreciated how it presented this folk singer as this kind of this guy who's almost like a manual laborer. Like he's always moving from place to place and he's always got all this shit with him. And he's just got to be like tired all the time. And there's like no joy to his work. And so I just kind of, one thing I liked is how it removed a lot of the romanticism of this era. And actually the casting of Garrett Hedlund is quite funny in that regard, because he was just in On the Road. So to put him in this film and his character is hilariously not talkative, that sort of speaks volumes. So yeah, I'm very high on this film.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to be the one who's the most cool on this film amongst all of us.
Mm.
It's not that I didn't like it, because I think I did. My problem with it is that I was really hoping I'd have a better handle on my feelings towards this film by the time we recorded this. There's something about the way that everything goes in this movie that I feel like I should have a lot more empathy with this character than I do. He's not a likable person, which I'm fine with, because most of the reasons he's unlikable, I'm sure, are the reasons that I'm unlikable. But I just never got in his head in a way that really helped me to connect with him. And there's something about him as a person that kept me on the outside. And I can identify with some pretty like despicable characters in films, but this guy just was kind of a garden variety asshole instead of like a really interesting one. And there's this kind of dark cloud that hangs over everything because of the recent suicide. Maybe recent. I don't even know how recent it was. Of his partner who jumped from the George Washington Bridge. And as is pointed out hilariously in a scene later on in the movie, that's not usually what people do. It's usually the Brooklyn Bridge. And I can get that. Like, I have that in my life. That's a situation and a context that I've had to deal with. So I should be able to really fit into that. And while I can a little bit, like, so little is made of it ever that it's just really keeping me on the outside, which sucks, because the music And the performances are all fantastic. And, I mean, it's a Coen Brothers film, so obviously it's going to have some really sharp comedy in there, too. I like their bleak worldview because it's kind of imbued with this tragicomic heightening of everything that I find interesting. Danny, I think one of my things is that you said it was a lot like A Serious Man, but in A Serious Man, all of his problems came through inaction, which made him both frustrating and also hilarious, but also empathetic, because you can understand a person who's like, I haven't done anything. Why is all this terrible stuff happening to me?
Mm-hmm.
I have a little bit harder time dealing with someone who's creating their own shit and can't even see it. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I personally, like I said, I'm a little bit like this character. When something terrible happens to me, I can draw the line to the thing that I did that made that happen. And usually that just makes me more miserable and more likely to do it again. But this guy, he just seems like he's completely ignorant to everything that he's done. So yeah, mild recommendation from me. There's just, like I said, there's just something I couldn't see about it. And I was actually really surprised at how completely unmoved I was at the end. Because they almost got me. There was a moment where I thought that they were about to finally turn it around. And I was actually excited at the idea that they might be able to pull off what they were trying, and it just didn't work. So, a little bit of a disappointment, but all in all, like I said, I think this is definitely a film worth checking out.
No, I will say that it's funny, because one of the things I found most compelling about it in terms of sort of the character and his situation is how so much of the movie is circular, and so much of the movie is about moving in circles and moving from one point and then back to another point and then back there and so on and so forth, which I think is really deeply embedded in the structure of the movie. For instance, I mean, the beginning and the end of the movie do mirror each other rather strongly. Yes. There's even the repetition of dialogue and the repetition of shots in the first 5 minutes and the last 5 minutes, but also...
Wait.
Yeah? Hello?
Yeah, I'm... Wait.
Hello?
It's good. I can hear you. Did you not get what happened at the end?
What?
The Hello? First scene is the last scene.
No, it's not.
Yes?
No, it's... What? No, it's
100%
not.
Yes, it is.
Danny?
I think there are a few minor discrepancies.
Yeah. They edit some stuff out of the initial scene, but it gets added in back at the other scene.
No, it's not.
Oh, that's interesting.
I swear, okay. It is impossible that they are not the same scene.
Why would they be that way? No, okay. Hold on.
No.
Because what happens in the movie is the character is always going, he's always repeating these actions. You have to look at, for instance, there's always the shot of him where he's going into Jim and Jean's apartment lobby and he's hitting the button and then he goes up and then he enters the door and she yells at him and then he goes back down. Or when he goes to the Gorfines' apartment, you know, he goes there and she's making her world famous, et cetera, et cetera. And then there are two guests there to whom he doesn't relate.
Right.
That's what the movie is doing, is how it's basically what it's suggesting at the end is that he's never going to really go anywhere significant. And he's always going to kind of be in the same place. And he's always going to be just out of reach of something greater, which is what the movie, I thought, stressed in a really interesting way. First of all,
but
there's the what?
I understand thematically what you're saying. I picked up on all that. And so for a while I was confused, but they open with one scene, jump back in time, and then play out everything leading up to that. And it's that you think that everything that you're watching is coming from what happened. And then you realize that everything that has, or that thing that happened is coming from everything that you're watching. That's what you're.
I don't think that's the case.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, this has never happened before, but I'm going to have to throw up a spoiler warning here. I mean, it really, you can't spoil it in my mind because I just said the beginning was the end. However, we're going to get into some stuff that's pretty specific right now. So, if you want to remain unspoiled, I don't think that the movie is diminished at all by knowing what's coming or happening. You still have the great performances and music and everything. But, fair warning, spoilers in the house. there is no possible way, even if they were doing a crazy, like, you know, he gets the shit beaten out of him once a week by the same southern drawl having hat wearing guy who's pissed off that he was yelling at his wife.
Mm-hmm.
You think that that is a completely separate human being? A person who rabbit punches him in the nose, then knocks him down, then punches him as he's laying down, and then kicks him before saying, I'm getting out of this cesspool, y'all can have it?
No, I think cesspool. It's the same guy.
You think that the same man comes with the same problem to him every week to beat him up?
Well, I mean, sure. I don't think it's supposed to make sense. I don't think... Because I think it's basically analogous to God in a serious man, which is to say it's just sort of this thing which comes by and fucks you up and then leaves.
You
and then
you think it's over. Goddamn mind,
and then it comes back. I know, because, okay, maybe we need... This review has gone so far off the rails already, but maybe we need Danny's insight here.
I mean, well, here's the thing. I mean, I don't feel that this review has gone off the rail. I think we've actually entered into, like, a real discussion right now, so I'm perfectly fine with this, because this is a lot of what the movie hinges on for me. This is how it almost got me. Because for a while, I was like, this guy just got the shit beaten out of him, and he's still being an asshole. But then you realize that this is all the stuff that happened leading up to that. I mean, he begins the movie by apologizing to the owner of the club, saying, like, sorry, I was such a mess last night. And the guy's like, ah, forget about it. And then he says, you know, your friend's outside, and this guy is saying that this guy, you know, you open your mouth, you know, she was up there performing. And you're just like, what the hell is he talking about? And then you see him doing all the things that they talked about
the previous night.
And suddenly it began to dawn on me, oh, holy shit, this is what I saw beginning. This is what was leading up to that. And mm-hmm. that's when you begin to empathize with him more, because you realize that he's not being an asshole for the sake of it. That was the culmination of a lot of terrible things that happened
mm-hmm.
and basically a loss of hope. And so by playing out that scene again from that level, you're able to kind of extrapolate backwards, like, you know, all the other stuff that happened.
Mm-hmm.
All the things in his life that have probably led him to this place. So instead of just being a jerk, he's a jerk with a reason.
Right.
Like, without the fact that that is the same scene played with just an added perspective, this mm-hmm. movie is, like, 50% worse in my head.
Oh, okay. Well, I suppose that makes some sense, but at the same time, I do think my point about it still stands, which is that the movie is about moving in circles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. The structure was very specific in that way.
And also how one thing I just found very affecting was the idea that things are always kind of just out of reach. For instance, there's an interesting use of the city of Akron, Ohio, and the lights of it.
Yeah.
And then at the end, there's similarly, actually in a very similar visual, there's a visual motif here where you have Akron, Ohio, and then you have a certain singer at the end of the movie who is off there. He's right within reaching distance, but he's still far away, and there's sort of the pull of history, which is going to keep them apart forever. To me, that's sort of the nerve endings of the movie. Are contained in those two shots, I think. And to that end, I found it very unsettling and very difficult to stomach. And yeah, I mean, to me, that's sort of where it came from. And I think that's why I also found him empathetic is because he's just doomed to repeat himself over and over. And sometimes, you know, you can't really stop that. So,
yeah,
bleak film.
It's very bleak.
I wonder, like, what like CBS Films thought, like, when they bought this, like, if they thought it was just like a funny Coen Brothers movie about a folk singer, not. I mean, this is basically, I think this is very, very similar to A Serious Man in many ways, both sort of in what the film is saying about the world, and even just its humor and the way it uses humor to kind of drill the character further into the ground. Weirdly enough, a lot of the same humor that they're using to sell the movie on a somewhat wide scale. That to me is very strange, but also quite interesting.
Yeah, like one of the most shocking sequences for me was the road trip to Chicago. And just like to pick up where Nick left off about the marketing, like the first line of the trailer is like Goodman's line about the bridge thing. And, you know, it's a really funny line. So like throughout this whole movie, I'm looking forward to John Goodman like coming in and providing comic relief. And instead he comes in and he's this like miserable heroin addict. And like that whole sequence is completely void of like any kind of joy or possible respite from like Lewin's existence in New York. It's actually like, at times it's almost surreal, like how strange that sequence is and how long it goes for. Like it's, I mean, I haven't timed it, but it goes on for much longer than you assume. And there's just a lot of disturbing things about that. And then like, obviously when he gets to the Gate of Horn, like that's a sort of classic scene and like probably one of the, most devastating one-liners that like I've heard recently. And so, yeah, like the fact that this movie has this circular structure, I feel like it really relies on that middle sequence to sell it because it's like, all right, this is like the one way he could possibly get out. But that's, you know, by the end of the sequence, he's just totally fucked.
Well stated.
And then, you know, the stuff with the dad, too, that's pretty... That was pretty sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty blistering portrait of really, like, just existential depression. Like, the way that things happen and the way that he has taken his music... And he started to compartmentalize it. Like, after the loss of his friend, he turns it into just his job. Like, it's just what he does. There's a scene where some people at a party want him to play, and he flips the hell out. And it's a powerful scene, because usually a musician would be glad to have a willing audience who is interested in hearing him. And he reacts to his own trade with this hatred and this disdain. And that's one of the other reasons why I like the formal structural mechanic of expanding on the last scene and showing that he played one more song after the first song that we hear him sing. And it's the song that he recorded with his partner before he died and that we've heard him play a few times. And it's the one time that he really lets emotion enter his work that we've heard in the entire film. And it's by far his best performance in the entire film. And I think that that's a lot of what this movie is about. It's about how his depression has kind of crippled him and how it sapped the joy from this thing that he used to care deeply about. And seeing him make that breakthrough and then get the shit beaten out of him by a man from Arkansas, I mean, that was even more wrenching, because it felt like he'd finally had a breakthrough, and that by putting that feeling into it, maybe he would get somewhere, and then life literally beat him down again.
Mm.
Stark stuff.
Yes.
But the good news is that he won't be able to go on his merchant seaman's vessel, so he might have to keep playing music anyway.
Hmm.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, like, if you had to extrapolate outwards from here, what do you see being the rest of Llewyn Davis's life?
Just, like, rich and, like, really happy and Jordan Belfort-esque.
God. So
Nick, Jordan Belfort is
the for people who don't know, he's the central character of the Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
So that would explain. I don't know. I mean, I guess I almost have to wonder, you know, because the movie is heavily based on the life of a guy named Dave Van Ronk,
mm-hmm.
who found sort of posthumous fame. I have to wonder if maybe there's a happy ending. I don't know. Maybe. I'm not counting on it, but No, I mean, I guess I have to wonder sort of, so I guess I was incorrect, and the movie actually really does sort of end with him, looking at a poster for a movie called The Incredible Journey. I'm looking up the poster right now. It says, a fantastic true life drama.
I also thought that was just funny because of that damn cat.
Well, yeah, sure. So I guess I don't know. I'm trying to figure out, does he actually go well? Does he go in a good direction? Not sure. It's this movie is really depressing.
But I mean, even that movie, two dogs and a cat trying to get home, like that's still a circular thing. They're just trying to get back to where they came from. Just like Ulysses, the cat, not the James Joyce or the character from Myth. Any final thoughts on this before we wrap up?
I like the music.
Oh, the music's fantastic.
Yeah, it was good. As I had tweeted last night, I was kind of pissed at this movie for getting me to be affected by anything Mumford related.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, but I really hate Mumford and Sons.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of them, but like that song, Fare Thee Well.
Yeah, admittedly, it was like half Oscar Isaac as well, but still, it was very beautiful.
And like I said, the best version of that song is the one that he sings alone at the end of the movie. So,
I like the movie very much. I don't know. I mean, right now, I think I'm watching like a lot of 2013 movies to kind of see what's working for my top 10. This might crack it. This might come in at like 10 or so, but you know, it doesn't. It doesn't really have to. You know, it's good.
I like it fine. But like I said, it was lacking some of the... I've realized that a lot of my top 10 is related to how it affected me emotionally. So this movie, having kept me at such a distance and not really being anything, you know, it's well-directed, like, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't have any, like, moments or scenes of sweeping visual beauty that I can latch onto. So it's probably going to stay outside my top 10.
Oh, really? I thought the cinematography was quite nice.
Oh, no. I mean, it's a beautiful film. There's just, like... I don't know. Like, if you can't reach me emotionally, you have to do something above and beyond visually to get me hooked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't there. So yeah, all in all, like, it's a fine film, but it's definitely not going to be my top 10.
Right.
One thing that's interesting about the music is that it's sort of one way to respond to this like broader dilemma about like how do you tell a story about an artist and like depict their art? And like, this came to mind actually recently because I watched this movie yesterday called In the House, which is about a literature teacher who reads one of his students' stories. And this story is like a real life account of the student's like voyeuristic behavior in his friend's home. And the teacher gets like wrapped up in it, and he encourages the kid to like go back into the home and keep snooping so he can keep writing. And the movie is just filled with voiceover of the kid's writing. And it's never interesting enough to make you think that this teacher would behave like such an idiot just to read this kid's writing. And so like, that's a bad example of how you respond to this. And one of the things Llewyn Davis does is that like it almost keeps his talent level like this elusive kind of question that almost doesn't even matter, because like we like can listen to him singing and be like really affected by it, and then like when F. Murray Abraham says like there's no money in it, you kind of like, yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, but then, it's like, but he's fine, like, he's not gonna set the world on fire though.
And so like, it's really complex how they managed to pull that off. And then obviously there are like side songs that are kind of purely comedic. Like, I love the scene where Timberlake and Mulligan are singing and the crowd starts singing with them.
Yeah.
And Oscar Isaac just turns around and he's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, he's just on nobody's wavelength. And that's sort of like his problem.
That was one of those scenes where I felt like I was really with him.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There's something about earnestness that really bums me out.
And something about earnestness that bums me out in certain settings, such as that.
Yeah.
I basically would have had the same reaction as him.
Yeah. I would have. Yeah. Yeah. Nick, you and I should hang out sometime.
I don't know. I actually.
Our surliness would envelop the world.
Last night I tweeted how much I related to it and whatnot. And then I got a response from critic Glenn Kenny, and he said, "Hey, me too. We definitely should not hang out." Awesome. Which I thought was funny.
All right. Well, that's our review of Inside Llewyn Davis. Yeah, out in limited release now. Check it out. It's a pretty damn good movie, and I'm probably gonna buy the soundtrack just for Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's get into the things that are coming out to DVD, Blu-ray, and in theaters. Then we'll give you our quick selection of something we watched from our own week, and we will talk to you next week. So Blu-ray and DVD, not a lot coming out. Not a lot. We have G.I. Joe Retaliation, Insidious Chapter 2, and Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
I think two of those already came out.
Right? I was about to say, I feel like some of these came out, but they're all I'm seeing. So
probably just reissues.
Yeah.
Wow, so...
More Than Honey.
More Than Honey, that's
quite an interesting film about honey.
Did you actually see it?
Nah.
Okay.
Wow, just watch an old movie or something.
Yeah. All right, let's just skip over this. All right, so coming out this week, either Christmas Day or the 27th, check your local listings to be sure. We have a couple of films. We have Lone Survivor, the newest film by Peter Berg. That is about a true life mission, I believe a SEAL team that was caught in hostile territory. Then we have The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, the newest film by Ben Stiller, starring Ben Stiller, based on the acclaimed short story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. We have The Wolf of Wall Street, hell yeah, the newest film by Martin Scorsese, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. And this is about, as we said earlier, the true story of Jordan Belfort, who was a Wall Street multimillionaire because of a bunch of malfeasance that he executed. Justin Bieber's Believe, moving on. 47 Ronin, newest film starring Keanu Reeves as a messianic savior figure fighting some witches or some shit like that. Grudge Match.
Yes.
Oh, a lot of goddamn films coming out. Grudge Match, which stars Robert De Niro and Sylvester Stallone as aging boxers who decide to go into the ring one more time. And August Osage County, which is, I don't even know, a look at the lives of the strong-willed women of the Weston family. That's according to IMDb. And finally, The Invisible Woman, directed by... It's Ralph Fiennes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even though it says Ralph.
Yeah, I don't know what's up with that dude.
Okay. So Ralph Fiennes stars and directs this film about Charles Dickens.
Oh my god.
His secret love affair. Wow, you really...
Well, I think the point is that there's only one movie.
I was about to say, now that I've named all of them, can we all just say Wolf of Wall Street?
Yes, Jesus Christ.
Great. Okay, so that's what we'll be talking
about. What about Grudge Match?
No.
Like MoviePass, I might.
Okay, Danny, if you go see Grudge Match and you wanna tell us about it, that's great. Right. That's great for me. But we will be talking about The Wolf of Wall Street next week when we do this. Yes, there will be one next week. We've already committed to it in our hearts and in our minds. So don't worry about like the last two times when I said something was coming and then we didn't pull it off. I will be in Houston, but I will be bringing all of my recording equipment with me. And hopefully I will be sober enough to give an accurate assessment of the film.
I don't know. That's a good movie to watch inebriated. Let me tell you.
I'm going
to
watch the movie sober or, you know, like, yeah, I'll watch it sober. I don't like to go to the movies drunk because when I'm drunk, I want to keep drinking and I can't do that at a movie theater, especially for a 3-hour long movie.
Yeah,
so the movie will be seen sober. However, when we record, I may be completely blitzed out of my mind. That's what Texas does, man. I go down there, all those people are like, "Hey, man, whiskey?" And I'm like, "Yeah." It's like a cowboy movie. It's crazy. Anyway.
Yeah, Wolf of Wall Street is fantastic. I love it so much. And
oh yes, Nick has seen it.
Yes, I have a review up on the site. It's kind of difficult to talk about in a non-spoilery way, or just when I say spoiler, I mean just because the film is basically scene after scene of debauchery. And, it's one of those films that it does get. There is certainly a lot to chew on, but sort of the immediate thoughts are just sort of reflecting back on the utter insanity and just kind of bursting out laughing. Because the movie is 3 hours long, not to get into too much, but because the movie is 3 hours long, there's so much that you kind of forget is happening just in a given scene. That, like, there's this conversation about dwarves in the movie that I can't believe is in a Martin Scorsese film. It really feels like something from a Judd Apatow movie, because it's just them sitting around talking about dwarves for like 3 minutes.
So okay. <funny. laughs> I cannot wait to see this movie.
Oh my god!
Anyway, let's save it for next week. Oh god. We'll talk about now briefly something we've seen in the past week that we think y'all should check out, and then we'll get out of here. So, Danny King, brief recommendation of something that you saw last week on your own that you think we should check out.
Well, that is a fascinating question. Do we usually talk about this?
I'd like to answer it in 10 parts.
Yeah, I don't know if we usually do this, but
honestly, we do. Yes.
Yeah, I've actually watched a lot of good movies this week, but like I don't want to mention one really briefly that I didn't like, but it's sort of funny to describe.
That's okay. I've done this.
All right, cool. It's like The Crossing Guard.
Okay.
So it was the second movie that Sean Penn directed, and I don't remember. Really remember Into the Wild that much, but I quite liked Sean Penn's film The Pledge with Jack Nicholson, and The Crossing Guard also stars Jack Nicholson. So I was like, okay, I'll put it on Netflix and give it a shot. It's a really bad movie, and it's sort of, if The Pledge is kind of interesting because it's sort of an atypical Nicholson role, this is like the most typical Nicholson role ever. He plays like an alcoholic jeweler, which is like I find really funny, but he's also, his kid was like killed in a car accident before the film began, and as the film is beginning, the perpetrator is getting out of prison. So there's an early scene where he goes to Angelica Houston's house, and there's sort of awkward tension there because I think they were actually like in a relationship in real life. And they had broken up by the time this movie was going. And so Sean Penn was like, you know, guys, we could really get some awesome truth here if you also play a sort of bitter couple in this film, which is, you know, kind of a cheap tactic. But he goes to her home, and he mentions, like, the guy is getting out of prison. And he's like, I can't wait to kill him. And she's, like, shocked. And he's like, admit to me that you're going to be happy once I've killed him. And she's just like, you're insane. Like, get out of my house. And so he's like a maniac. And then he goes and tries to shoot the guy, and his gun is out of bullets. And so he's like, okay, I'll give you like 3 days to live, and then I'll come back and my gun will be loaded.
Okay.
And so the movie's about like, those three days, and he's just like this drunk who hangs out in strip clubs and is like wanting to kill this guy, and it sounds like as bad as it is, because everything's just so arbitrary. Like, why is he showing up without bullets if he's been waiting to do this for 5 years, and why is he giving him 3 days to like think over and prepare for his death? Like, it just makes no sense.
Why wouldn't the guy just go to the police and say, this man is threatening to kill me?
Right. I mean, there's actually, like, that guy's played by David Morse, and he actually gives a kind of interesting performance.
I do love David Morse.
Yeah, so he gives, like, the
best performance, which is in its last few episodes.
Right. So he kind of sells this idea that, like, the character is still feeling this guilt, so he'd kind of be happy to die. Okay. But there's an even worse supporting character in Robin Wright, who like plays a potential love interest for David Morse. And there's a scene where he's like feeling really guilty, and he's like telling her about it, and she like turns on her radio and she's like, do you want to dance? And he's like, no, like, I'm talking about this like girl I killed, like I'm not in the mood to dance. And so the scene like continues for this really uncomfortable period of time as she's just like dancing and he's like not. And like that's the scene. it's completely meaningless and awkward to watch, and they're just a really bad example of like an actor turned director.
Why did you watch this?
I watched it because like I was a little bit bored, and like I remember The Pledge was good. yeah, but like, and I mean, it is. I actually like just the idea of Nicholson playing like an alcoholic jeweler. I find that like really funny. Like there are a few scenes where he's in his jewels shop, and like it's kind of funny. But like,
can you imagine draws Sean Penn to directing these films?
Yeah, I don't know. And like, he wrote this film, and there's just so much writing in it that feels like an actor, you know, trying to write about like grief and stuff.
Oh God.
Yeah, it's really, really
sounds
bad. Really,
yeah, it sounds really dreadful.
Yeah, and it's
okay.
Yeah.
So I looked up this film and I decided to look at the like suggested things along with it on IMDb. This is what the IMDb explanation for A Few Good Men is. Neo-military lawyer Caffey defends Marines accused of murder. Hmm. Neo-military?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe like neophyte?
Admittedly, I've actually never seen that film, so
oh,
I can't comment too directly.
Oh, fucking God.
But written by my favorite, Aaron Sorkin.
Good Lord, how have you not... dude.
Oh, Nicholson's in that.
Go see A Few Good Men, Nick.
Yeah, maybe.
Jesus. Okay. Anyway, Nick, why don't you give us your recommendation?
I didn't watch A Few Good Men this week or any other week of my life. but I did watch. I'm gonna go past the 2013 movies because who needs to hear about those that I've been watching. I think I'll go with Barking Dogs Never Bite, which is the feature debut of Bong Joon-ho, the South Korean filmmaker who is best known for his work in quote-unquote genre cinema, but is kind of considered perhaps the best genre filmmaker working today for the way he elevates some more yarny trappings, some more yarny stories above their trappings. And unfortunately, has kind of been in the news as well because his new feature, Snowpiercer, is being dicked around by the Weinstein Company.
Yep.
Because Harvey Weinstein is kind of a cunt flap. So,
wow.
In the meantime...
Wow.
Yes. So, as it is right now, that's kind of in a limbo state, but it might be going well, maybe. Anyway, his film, Barking Dogs Never Bite, has a very good setup, which is about a man who lives in an apartment complex and is very disturbed by the sound of his neighbor's dog constantly barking, so he decides to kill it to kind of just deal with his problems. But he winds up being spotted by a woman. And she kind of goes after him and tries to figure out, she does an investigation to figure out who this guy is and so on and so forth. Kind of a simple setup, but the film is actually, narratively, it's actually rather naughty, which I appreciated, although I do think the movie does kind of overextend itself a bit and trying to capture as much as it does when it really is just sort of a simple crime tale. Nevertheless, it's a very enjoyable movie. It's extremely well directed in sort of the, how would I put it? If you've seen South Korean cinema of recent years, you can kind of imagine how the film is constructed visually. Definitely feels like filmmakers such as Bong Joon-ho and Park Chan-wook and Kim Ji-woon kind of come from the same school. They may literally come from the same school for all I know, but they definitely have similar eyes. And I think...
Racist.
In the... Oh, hey, hey, that's not right. Jesus.
Oh, God, it was right there.
I mean, that might be true as well, if we're being practical. But speaking more metaphorically of their eyes, you know, one of the things I really liked about this movie is that it kind of, it takes this very darkly humorous story, but it isn't really ostentatious about it. It does play it as a very kind of, or plays it depressingly straight, even when it is humorous. which I don't think is an easy thing to do. And it was something I also found about his 2009 film Mother. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, that's the only other feature of his I've seen, but definitely one that makes me explore a bit further. So yeah, I like the movie. And also a very good performance from Duna Bay, who was later in Cloud Atlas.
The Wachowski film.
Yes.
Wachowski?
Let's not forget that Tickver was on that.
Yes.
Tickver, absolutely.
By far the more interesting of that trifecta.
Fine director.
She is, well, she's terrific in the movie. And no, overall I did like this work of cinema.
Excellent. I'm gonna go with a simple one. I've seen it before, but I watched again the film Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol.
Oh, I was just hoping you were gonna say Mission Impossible.
No. I'm perfectly fine with Mission Impossible, don't get me wrong. But so Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. Fantastic movie.
Go to call,
yes.
As back when that film came out in the brighter days of December 2011, we at the film stage referred to it as Go to Call.
Yep.
And it caught on a bit.
It did.
So now with Mission Impossible 5 coming in 2 years' this time, we're at the halfway points between Go to Call and Mission Impossible 5.
That's crazy. That's actually when I got hired onto the film stage.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, a little synchronicity.
Right in the middle of Go to Call fever.
So hopefully when they reveal the subtitle of that film, if there is a subtitle to it, we'll have to come up with an abbreviation. That'll take all of 15 seconds.
Anyway, so the movie's fantastic still. Like, so there's that centerpiece thing that was in all the trailers where he's on that, like, the world's largest building in the middle of Dubai. And even just watching it on, like, the 40 or 50-inch TV that we have in my living room here, because I saw that in IMAX, and that scared the shit out of me. And even sitting alone on my couch watching this movie, the second that he steps out of that window, I without even realizing it was happening, I said, no fucking way. Like, I was like, no, goddamn it. Like, I was still on the edge of my goddamn seat. Like, and a lot of this has to do with the actors who are involved, who are all great. Lea Seydoux is in it.
Yeah. Oh, right.
She of Blue is the Warmest Color. I mean, she has
she's awesome.
She is, like, yeah, I mean, she's pretty kick-ass in that movie. So, both of them, I guess. And that, not only that, but the direction by Brad Bird. Like, that man, coming from animation as he does, and being such a freaking master at that, and then coming to live action and bringing so much of that energy and craft and skill, like that it's just like one of the most solid rewatchable, I've now affirmed, action films that, like, in recent memory.
I saw that at the Lincoln Square IMAX in New York City, which is one of the biggest IMAX screens in the world. And listeners may not know this, but I am deathly afraid of heights.
Oh my god, me too.
So you can imagine that, because that was shot with an IMAX camera, so it fills up the entire screen. You can imagine just sitting, like, in the middle of that theater looking at it. I had my knees up to my ears, basically. But I'd say that was very, I mean, obviously, like, he's going to be fine, because, like, come on. But still, that's the sign of an expertly crafted action scene. And you know who doesn't like that movie is Danny King.
I wasn't crazy about it when I saw it. Certainly, that centerpiece sequence looked nice on the IMAX screen. There was definitely some other parts of the film that had traits. Tom Cruise.
And doesn't everything have a trait?
Yeah, no, that was an intentionally meaningless statement. Yeah, I didn't really go for it at the time. Be curious to revisit Go to Call. Perhaps if I go in with the shorthand title in mind, I'd be more in the spirit.
Maybe. All right, well, so that's it for this week. Check out everything that we've talked about, because it's all pretty good, apparently. Let's tell the people where you can be found in the meantime, between next week and... Oh, fuck this. Okay. let's tell the people at home where we can be found between now and next week's podcast, which again will be on Martin Scorsese's newest film, The Wolf of Wall Street. So, Nick Newman, where can we find you online?
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and riding around from New York to Chicago.
All right, Danny King.
FilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
And you can find me passing the basket around at the Gaslight. You can also find me on Twitter at Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. My personal website, DearFilm.net, where I have published two reviews recently, one of Out of the Furnace, kind of a mounted defense of it, and Nebraska. So check that out if you want more of my thoughts on the Nebraska. And thefilmstage.com, where I'm currently helping. I think we're all contributing to our continued rollout of best whatevers of 2013, correct?
Yeah.
Check all those out. We have a pretty comprehensive and in-depth list of things like best breakout performance, best ensemble, best overlooked film, best film that exceeded expectations, amongst many, many others. That wasn't written out for me to read, so I just decided to say it as though I did, because that was obviously a plug. Anyway, thanks everyone for joining us, and again, join us next week for our review of The Wolf of Wall Street.